One fine day, Britain's empire on the brink. The Palestine Mandate became law on 29th of September 1923, and the British Empire now covered a scarcely credible quarter of the world's landmass. Just 460 million people. Largest empire the world had ever seen, but it was beset by debt and doubts. Delighted to be joining me live on the line, the author of One Fine Day, Britain's Empire on the Brink, Matthew Parker. Matthew, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us. So was the Saturday, the 29th of September, 1923, if you like, the high watermark of Britain's empire? And it was a quarter of the world landmass being run by the British. Was this as good as it got, presumably?
Well, certainly in terms of territorial extent, this was the high point. And in fact, only a few weeks later, little bits of the empire were sort of peeled away. And as we all know, the shrinking of the empire happened very rapidly. But this was the moment of its greatest territorial extent. And it's really sort of mind-boggling. This is only 100 years ago. This is within two or three generations. My grandparents were around on this day. And here we are 100 years later in a very different situation. But it is astonishing that you can actually walk from Cape Town in South Africa to Rangoon in Burma without leaving British-controlled territory. And this population, 460 million, that's more than Russia, the United States, and the French Empire combined. So it's a staggering that this small island off the coast of Europe was, at that time, the sole global superpower.
Presumably, it all comes down, a major factor in this is British naval superiority. Britannia rules the waves. In an age before aircraft, obviously, there are some knocking around in the 20s, but nothing like we have at the moment. Britain's foreign policy was pretty much decided or underlined by the Royal Navy, and it was formidable.
Yeah, that's right. It had it was twice the size of any other navy, and it was the key strategic weapon. You could project power around the world in the way that you couldn't with a continental army or something like that. Aircraft shouldn't be underestimated. They've been one of the reasons why this was for some an optimistic moment is that troubles in Ireland and Egypt and Iraq. There'd been a huge revolt in Iraq a couple of years previously, and this had been suppressed by aircraft. They bombed the villages and they bombed the flocks, and that achieved their goal. And this was actually quite a cheap way to run the empire, much cheaper than the traditional punitive column with sort of mules and artillery. So this was a way to control empire on the cheap. But you're right that the key weapon was the navy, and it was an sea empire, which meant that in many ways it didn't really make strategic sense. The closest allies, people like Australia, were actually on the other side of the world. And this would prove to be part of the reason for the empire's vulnerability at that moment. As I said, there was optimism, but there were doubts and there were severe challenges that the British were facing at this time.
And also, you're looking at the time period. This is 1923. So this is 5 years after the end of the Great War. And of the three royal families that go into the First World War, it's only the House of Saxe-Coburg/Windsor that is actually standing by the end of it. So the empire kind of looks invulnerable at that point, surely.
Well, you're right. There've been collapses of empires. The First World War really changed everything. And before the war, pretty much the whole of the world, with the possible exception of bits of South America, was part of an empire. But by 1918, the Russian Empire had collapsed. The Americans had retreated into isolation. The Ottoman Empire, of course, had collapsed. The German, the Austro-Hungarian. And so this is really points to some of the doubts that people were having. Empire was suddenly a bit old-fashioned. It seemed like the age of empires was over. And it was only really the British and the French who were still left standing. And you've got to also remember that there's huge changes in Britain. There's mass franchise mass voting has been introduced in 1918 for the first time for all adult men and most adult women over the age of 30. So here you have real democracy at home. And people were saying, is this really compatible with imperial autocracy abroad? So empire, for some, had become a dirty word. And there would be new challenges, partly also because of the Treaty of Versailles, which obviously gave the British huge chunks of the old German and Turkish empires. But they were under this system of mandates, League of Nation mandates. And the manifesto for that was very clear that they should be governed, these territories should be governed for the benefit of the indigenous people and with a view to moving them to self-government as quickly as possible. And this idea wasn't really containable, and soon it was being applied to the empire as a whole. So people in London were saying there was an imperial conference just starting on my day. People were saying, well, you know, what is the purpose of the empire? It didn't really have any economic purpose. It didn't really have military purpose. Was it just there to dismantle itself? Was its only existence to basically liquidate itself? So this is what you said at the beginning that it was beset by doubts, and these are some of the doubts that people were facing.
But of course, back in 100 years ago, we're bringing, and I use these in huge parentheses, Matthew, we're bringing civilization and British values to the world, basically, and that surely couldn't be a bad thing. If I was 100 years ago, or in 1922 or something like that, sitting there having a cup of tea, you know, in Croydon or Slough or Welwyn Garden City, I would think, well, we're bringing the values of these new towns to the uncivilized world.
Yeah, I mean, certainly sort of cheerleaders of empire would point to the benefits that the empire bestowed. And these were sort of peace, Pax Britannica, health, modern Western medicine, education, the rule of law, and development, and even democracy in some cases. But all of these are actually quite complicated. I mean, if you look at medicine, actually more people were dying of the imported diseases that the Europeans brought into places like the Pacific than were ever being helped by Western medicine. If you look at the rule of the peace, someone like Kenya. Kenya had been for many years riven with sort of tribal conflicts and terrible bloodshed, and the British put a stop to this. But in the First World War, there was a battle fought in the German colony of Tanzania, which was invaded from the north. And because of the nature of the land and because of the Tsetse fly, the only way you could sort of move an army's sort of equipment was by porter. So something like 300,000 porters were recruited from Kenya. And something like 100,000 of them died of disease or malnutrition. So as Kenyan nationalists pointed out, hold on, you know, more people have died in your war than in generations of tribal conflict. And in other ways, development is all of these things, they are nuanced, shall we say. They're complicated.
So much, so far, so strategic, so big picture. You know, saying, well, we had these bits and the world was covered in pink bits of British Empire. But what your book does as well is it breaks it down to correspondence of the time. So we get the people. Because you know, the thing about history is vibrant and it's living and it's first-person accounts that really bring that to life. How did you go about picking out from 460 million people in the empire those to choose?
Well, what I did, I was very strict with myself. What I didn't want to do, which I think some historians are guilty of, is come to this with a sort of a ready-made opinion and a polemic. What I wanted to do is, as you said, the book is about people and stories. So what I did, I set myself a rule that all of the stories had to be have at least as a jumping-off point this day, the 29th of September. And what I do is I start where the sun rises in the Pacific, and I travel with the sun across Burma, India, Australia, and then Africa, and ending up in the Caribbean, and then back around to Pacific. And all of the stories come from newspapers. This is very much the heyday of newspapers. Radio, obviously no TV or internet, radio is in its infancy. I mean, the BBC is only founded in 1922. And in fact, the 29th of September was the date of the first publication of the Radio Times. So anyway, so radio, it hasn't caught up, and there are hundreds of newspapers being published all over the empire. And so I trawled through these, and they're so fascinating. You learn so much. Even the adverts are really interesting. But I found, for instance, a story about highlighted called "The Dying Races," and this pushed me to a science conference that was happening in Australia discussing the population collapse in the Pacific. So that then. But through that, I can sort of unpack the medical claims of the empire's cheerleaders, for example. And then I went through a lot of official documents, and one I found was a telegram sent from the colonial office on this day to the governor of Kenya, complaining about the outcome of a recent trial of a white settler who had beaten one of his African workers to death. So that then jumps off into the actually appalling coercion of labor in Kenya and the background to that. So these are jumping offs. And as you said, I'm not an academic. It's not an academic book. It's about people and stories.
Suppose it's an interesting point that you don't bring a preconceived idea, because I'm not going to, I'm not going to drop the dread W word in here, but there is an awful lot of soul searching, quite rightly too, about the empire and what it means. But as you said at the beginning, the mandates basically said that the people would be able to govern themselves. And we see that in India, obviously, straight after the Second World War. It's one of the reasons that, we have the Indian Army gets involved. And 30 years after the newspaper report of the Kenyan farmer beating worker to death, we have 55, the Mau Mau and Kenyan independence, and that whole swathe of African nations in the late 50s and early 60s being granted their own nations.
That's right. And actually, really interestingly, at the time, people were questioning empire and whether it was actually beneficial to the people who were sort of being the governed. And a lot of people had very mixed feelings about, there's someone who I followed quite a lot called Hugh Clifford, who was in 1923, he was governor of Nigeria, which is a very important colony. But he started off in Malaya, and he was actually responsible for something like 100 square miles of Malayan territory being incorporated into the empire. And he wasn't actually sure this was a good thing. He really, he weighed it up. He saw that a lot of the practices that certainly humanitarians back in London were objecting to, like sort of debt bondage and compulsory labour, were abolished by the British. But at the same time, he said, hold on, the boot of the white man stamps out much that is important and vital in terms of the local culture and also self-respect. He said, the Malays, now they're in the empire, they have no respect for themselves. They're becoming feeble. There's people who are much more overt. I mean, there's a guy called Eric Blair, who is a young policeman in Burma. He's now famous as George Orwell.
I was about to mention Burmese days. I was just thinking about Burmese days and when you were talking about that.
Yeah, and if anyone who's read Burmese Days will know that it is a brutal picture of the empire and how the colonial setting is really sort of ruins everything, not just for the British, who are portrayed as absolutely ghastly, but also the Burmese and the Indians in Burma. There's not a sympathetic character in that novel. And for Orwell, it was a transformative experience. He went out as a self-confessed sort of odious little snob and a prig, and he came back, of course, as this great campaigner for the underdog.
And it's not, as I said before, it's not just about governors and it's not about sort of governor generals, etc. It is about, you found sort of not lesser characters, but less well-known people in that.
Well, one of the things, yes, I mean, there's nurses and there's sort of, very junior people in the British administration. But one of the ambitions for this book was to include as many colonized voices as I possibly could. And this is one of the reasons why it took me so long. It's actually been 8 years from start to finish to produce this book, so ruinously long time. But finding those is not easy for obvious reasons, because history is written by the powerful. But I have found some, and some of them will be well known, like Marcus Garvey. He's a very important figure at this time, and he's trying to overturn the feelings of inferiority that has been imposed upon Black people in particular. I mean, there's a great quote by Norman Manley, who's later the Prime Minister of Jamaica, saying British rule and the British Empire depends on the carefully nurtured sense of inferiority in the governed. And this is being challenged by people like Garvey. And there's also a fascinating character called Adelaide Casey Hayford, who is a Sierra Leonean, who was actually brought up in Jersey. But goes back out to Sierra Leone, and she's appalled that the education system there seems to teach Black children that they are inferior, and that everything British and white is superior to everything Black and African. And she takes this on, and she sets up, opening on the 29th of September, a technical school for girls to teach them independence and be able to earn their own living, but also in the hope that they would be much prouder of their African heritage and of their Black skin, and stop, you know, the sort of bleaching products and the hair straightening products that Garvey railed against. You know, they wanted to see off all of that sort of self-hatred that had been imposed on them by the colonial system.
And presumably other colonized nations, also, you know, the Canadians, the South Africans, the Australians, they obviously have their stories to tell, and they must be fascinating as well, because we always talk about, you know, and quite rightly too, the African nations, the Caribbean nations, the Asian nations getting their independence. But, you know, the relationship between the Crown and, let's face it, you know, white civilized people in South Africa, Boer War not without standing, you know, Canada, New Zealand and Australia is also a fascinating one.
Yeah, I mean, I was very careful to include all of that. I mean, it's helped by the fact that there's this imperial conference happening, which is the sort of high table of the empire, where all the dominion leaders, so that's Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, Canada, and Ireland for the first time, they all get together in London, and they try to sort of put together a common foreign policy and that sort of thing. And this conference really displays the lack of unity and purpose amongst these dominion leaders. Remember that the war, all of them had produced very large armies to fight for the British against the Central Powers. And arguably, their contribution, as well as India's, made the difference between victory and defeat for Britain. So this in a way, was a sort of a great rallying sort of empire unity. But it came, of course, at a huge cost. The populations back in Australia and Canada particularly were deeply divided. Many did not support the sacrifices that were being made. And the year before, there had been what's known as the Shanak crisis, where it looked like there was going to be a restart of war with Turkey. And the British just assumed that they could rely on these white dominions to again produce troops. And they said, hold on, you can't automatically declare war on our behalf like you did in 1914. We're not having that anymore. It's down to us whether we support. So there's a lot of friction there,
and especially against the Turks, as we all know what had happened at Gallipoli and the losses that were suffered by the Dominion forces in that.
Exactly. Yes. So they didn't want a repeat of that. Certainly.
What do you hope then that people will take from One Fine Day?
One of the sort of recurring themes, there's a disparate group of very different stories, but there are sort of linking themes. And one of the things that comes up again and again is the lack of understanding and ignorance. Indians who went to Britain were amazed that no one in Britain really knew anything about India or really cared. And I think I want people to know more about the complexity of the empire. And people sometimes say, you know, the empire is good, empire is bad. It's that's not, it's so disparate. It's so different in different places. And it's so, there's so much nuance and complexity about it. And that's really what this book, what this book is, the ambition of it is what it's about, yeah.
And if you could just nip back 100 years and have a cup of tea and a biscuit with one of the people that you wrote about, because you do film, you form a bond with these people because you're writing about them, you're in, you know, you're in their lives. Who would it be?
There's so many fascinating characters. There's an amazing person called Herbert Macaulay, who is the sort of, he's the sort of Nigerian Gandhi. He's the father of Nigerian independence. And on my day, the political party that he had set up, the first political party in West Africa, was still celebrating an election win in Lagos. And he was next to, if you see a picture of him, he's got this amazing moustache. He dresses immaculately. I mean, lots of Africans are now, for the first time wearing African dress, they're returning to what they call native costume, but not for him. He was a real thorn in the side of the Nigerian government, but at the same time, he was a massive cheerleader for the empire as a whole and for what he saw as British values of law and fairness and equality, amazingly. So he's this one of these very complex figures who is a very rounded, complicated person. He would be a fascinating person to meet.
The book is called One Fine Day, Britain's Empire on the Brink. It's by Matthew Parker, who we've been speaking to today. Matthew, if people want to find out more about you or about the book, where can they go?
Well, I have a website, matthewparker.co.uk, and I'm on Twitter, MatthewParker7070.
And having spent 8 years on this book, Matthew, are you going to maybe put another one together, or do you think you're going to give yourself a long break after this particular?
I'm going to have a big lie down, I think, for a little while. This is my seventh book, and it's the one that I've really, really most proud of. So I'm hoping that a lot of people will enjoy it.
Well, it'll be available as a virtual download from our own virtual bookstore. The book is called One Fine Day, Britain's Empire on the Brink. It's by Matthew Parker. Matthew, thank you so much for your time today.
It's been a pleasure, Joel. Thanks.